Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 171, recorded Thursday, January 14th, 2021. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: leaving data behind in a rental car and 2021 travel planning pro tips. Coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, stayed off the road over the entire holiday season, which let me skip the TSA's new post-lockdown record of 1.3 million people on January 3rd, which was the last Sunday of the holiday season. Though, to be fair, this is only just over half the 2.4 million passengers who flew on the same Sunday last year. And with every U.S. airline except Delta now back to selling middle seats, it makes sense that load factors also ratcheted up over the holidays. I haven't seen any industry-wide numbers yet, but American's COO did say that the load factor on their 737 MAXs over the last week of the holiday season was 90%. Now, most of those MAXs are flying between LaGuardia and Miami, which is always a busy holiday route, but I've seen reports of many other packed flights in addition to much higher passenger loads. I was never a big fan of completely full flights pre-coronavirus, and as you can imagine, am even less excited now, kind of pre-widespread vaccine distribution. So I'm not too bothered that we didn't try to get out of town over the holidays. However, staying in town through the rest of January is a whole different thing, because January is absolutely the worst part of Chicago's winter. So after Thanksgiving weekend, on what used to be called Cyber Monday, when we actually shopped in physical stores, but on that quote-unquote Cyber Monday, instead of trolling through Amazon, I was trolling through travel sites looking for cheap flights to somewhere warm the third week of January. I figured that'd be long enough kind of for the post-holiday COVID spike to work its way through the system. I'd had some friends who'd gone down to Mexico, felt safe in the tourist zones, didn't have any problems, came back healthy. But I don't do well sitting on a beach for more than a day or two, and I wanted to keep it, I don't know, a bit simpler. So we decided to stay in the U.S., which pretty quickly narrowed our search to Southern California, South Florida, and Arizona. And since we'd spent time last winter in both Arizona and Florida, we decided to do California and, you know, go as far down the coast as we could get, which was San Diego. And as luck would have it, Southwest had cheap direct flights from Chicago Midway, and I had Southwest travel credits from one of last spring's flight cancellations kind of burning a hole in my virtual pocket. So, boom, I booked it. On what turned out to be, I don't know, 3 days before California's governor locked down most of the state. But a friend hit the ground there a week before Christmas in San Diego and said, you know, it's not really a problem. So we stayed the course, didn't really pay any attention to it until after New Year's, when we thought, you know, we probably ought to look into booking a place to stay. And that's when we started to pay attention. Bike and kayak rental places were open as quote-unquote outdoor recreation businesses, but vacation rental and hotel booking sites all pointed to the California Public Health Department statement: no hotel or lodging entity in California shall accept or honor out-of-state reservations for non-essential travel, which our January snowbird getaway definitely didn't qualify as. Would things ease up, you know, in a couple of weeks? The trend lines on the state's COVID website didn't seem to be pointing in that direction. So last Monday, when I received yet another blast of airline sales emails, it seemed like the right time to pivot. So crossing off California, we were now back to Florida and Arizona. We talked to some friends already down in Florida. They said the south beaches were already filling up with snowbirds. So we opted for, I don't know, drier sand and swung our Southwest flights over to Phoenix. But since we'd been in Phoenix last winter and kind of continuing in that spirit of visiting not quite A-list places in the U.S. that we've never been to as we're weaving around quarantines, we're driving further south down I-10 to Tucson. We're running the same travel planning playbook that we did for our August trip to Michigan's UP, focus on outdoor activities like hiking and biking, have backups in case of last-minute closures, and, above all, build a list of microbreweries with outdoor seating. So following up, back at the beginning of December, when the Pfizer vaccine approval was imminent and the Moderna approval wasn't far behind, most travelers, myself included, got a bit giddy and started to think about the world opening up in the spring, the summer at the latest. Fast forward 30 days and Happy New Year. That initial blast of vaccine optimism melted when it met kind of the ugly realities of last-minute logistics. Wading into my inbox and spelunking through the stream of low-fare emails from American and Southwest and Delta and United and Iberia and British Airways, the consensus across airline demand forecasters seems to be that nothing's going to change until the end of May. But even that doesn't explain why, say, American sends out an email pushing plan a European vacation that includes spring fares, you know, fares in March, April, May, to places like Manchester and London and Madrid. I mean, I don't know anyone who expects European vacation travel to open up in the next 3 to 4 months. I mean, give credit to Delta for highlighting more achievable destinations. Cancun, the Bahamas, Phoenix, and just about every airport in Florida with a runway long enough to handle a jet. What will be interesting is what the airlines and hotels do about elite status protection if travel continues to be slow through the summer. Remember that last spring, after it was clear that business travel was canceled for most of 2020, all the big travel companies grandfathered in everyone's status for the year. I mean, what you earned in 2019, you kept through this year, 2021. So you didn't have to re-earn it in 2020. But now what? I mean, we talked about this a bit in the November episode, episode number 169, when the companies kind of made their opening bids, knocking 20 to 30% off of their elite qualifying clip levels. Kind of like these low fare sales, it's going to be interesting to see what the new offers are come May. We talked in prior episodes about the challenges of planning a trip during COVID, deciphering lockdown rules, parsing what can seem to be the almost theological differences between stay-at-home advisories and stay-at-home orders. And after all that, trying to keep up to date on last-minute changes, things are just changing so fast, open, shut, outdoor seating versus just doing takeout, that the normal crowdsourcing tools we'd use, things like Google Maps, Yelp, just can't keep up because they don't have a real-time view, or at least they don't offer a real-time view. Now, the Foursquare app used to do that many years ago, but since they split off Swarm, which was their check-in app, or is their check-in app, though I don't know anybody who really uses it anymore, when they split that off of the mainline Foursquare, it seems that that real-time data is now kind of locked behind a paywall and just sold to business customers to target mobile ads. But one app that I use does provide a real-time view into some traffic, and that app is Untappd. Yeah, it's just craft beer nerd traffic, people checking in their beers at tap rooms and beer bars, but that's the kind of traffic I'm kind of interested in. And so after our pivot to Tucson, I wanted to see what beer places were open for service, not just takeout. Now, I could have spent some time clicking around the app, but instead, I decided to put one of my lockdown self-improvement projects to use. Over the fall, I'd taken some online Python programming courses on Coursera, just trying to sort of refresh some, I don't know, 30, 40-year-old brain cells. So I wrote a short program that pulled the most recent Untappd check-ins from the Tucson area, and then with that, I started to make a list of places that are open. Now, I probably could have made that list quicker by just plunking away on the app, but I tell you, not with that same sense of achievement. We talked about COVID-19 vaccination and test certification in the last episode. Over the last month, it seems that proof of negative test results rather than proof of vaccinations is kind of the new hotness. Canada, the UK, and now in the next couple of weeks, the US, the latest countries requiring a negative COVID test for inbound international travelers. It makes sense. The CDC released a paper in November in what is one of my favorite publications, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. For those of you interested and really kind of want to get in on that, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Anyhow, in November, they published a paper saying that temperature and symptom screening at airports is pretty worthless. It only picked up one case for every 85,000 passengers screened. So not hard for the switch to pre-flight testing to be more effective. For Canada and the UK, though, they've layered the test requirements on top of their existing 14-day quarantine requirements, which just adds, quite honestly, adds to the confusion and the complexity. And especially in the case of Canada, the Canadian government gave travelers 1 week notice of the new testing requirements. Now, I haven't seen the U.S. regulations yet, but the Canadian rules say that you must have, quote unquote, proof in hand of a negative test before boarding the plane to Canada. And that proof can be either electronic or paper. Now, you got to think that pretty quick, that proof in hand has got to default to proof on phone. Otherwise, forged paper results are going to be the new fake IDs from our teens. I mean, last November, French cops busted a ring selling fake test results at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The going rate was 150 to 300 euros a fake test, which converts to something like $180 to $370. Now, that compares to $125 for a good fake driver's license. So there's money to be made. Now, since the last episode, the Caribbean country of Aruba was the first country to standardize on one of the digital passport apps that we talked about in the last episode. They standardized on Common Pass. That's the app backed by the World Economic Forum, the Davos gang. And as we mentioned, that's also used by United Air for their Newark to Heathrow flight. But then Singair picked the rival app, Travel Pass, that comes from IATA, to use for flights to and from Malaysia. So it still seems like when it does go to proof on phone, we're just going to need to set aside some memory and screen space for a bunch of apps. And hey, if you have any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can always send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can always write your comments on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is leaving data behind in a rental car. A couple of weeks back, I retweeted a news article. The third suspect charged in the fatal shooting of a retired Chicago fireman during a carjacking was caught because he'd synced his phone to the audio system of the stolen car. Now, I don't know, fleeing a murder but worrying about getting a ticket for not using hands-free? You know, I don't know, go figure. Good that they caught the bad guy. But is there a lesson in there for us law-abiding frequent travelers? When the Avis or Hertz person walks up to me at the car return lane, they always remind me not to leave anything behind. Remember to take my sunglasses, my mobile phone, but they never remind me to delete all the data that I've synced to the car. And with more of our lives getting stored in our phones, I asked Andrea Amico, founder of the company Privacy for Cars, to come onto the podcast to talk about the privacy problems at that intersection of cars and smartphones. Andrea, welcome to the Travel Commons podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here today.
Let's start off. How did you get involved in this space?
One of the companies I used to run was one of the largest used car inspection companies. We inspected a lot of vehicles that were ready to be sold. I just noticed that people were leaving basically their digital lives behind.
So we first talked about the privacy security issues around pairing your smartphone with your car rental about 4 years ago. And Bluetooth-enabled entertainment systems were just becoming more common in rental car fleets, really as hands-free call laws became widespread. You know, even today, the first thing I do is to sync my iPhone. And as I've noticed, more times than not, the sync slots, they're full. you know, personalized names, you know, Jan's iPhone, Timmy's iPhone. You know, you end up having to delete at least one of them to make room for yours. And then once paired, most phones by default end up downloading all your contacts and your phone numbers and things like that. So Jan and Timmy have left behind all of their contacts and all their phone numbers. And I mean, that's just bad in so many ways.
When you sync your phone through Bluetooth or you plug it into the USB port, or now some newer cars, you just walk into the car and the car automatically sniffs your phone and starts syncing to it, including now with Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. When that happens, you are creating a mini clone of your phone inside the vehicle.
What other information are people leaving behind when they don't clear themselves out of a rental car?
Oh, all sorts. Your phone book, your call logs, the text messages, including the body, meaning the actual text of the text messages. That stuff will be left behind, but also all sorts of metadata that allows criminals or law enforcement or just people who want to snoop on you to re-identify you. Anything from the identifiers of your phones, which are unique, your Bluetooth MAC address, not to mention, of course, all your navigation data. I mean, you can reconstruct where people have been just by data that has been stored in the infotainment system. And then you have whether you are on Twitter and Facebook and what are the handles of those things, what are the last photos you have taken, what files have you synced, emails, calendar entries. There's all sorts of stuff that people really don't understand that they're leaving behind.
But when people do delete pairings, so when I'm doing that, am I deleting all that information or is there some data still retained in that vehicle?
By and large, deleting the data following the manufacturer directions is helpful in preventing third parties to having access. And so if there is anything left behind, it requires a much deeper forensic type of analysis that is typically not accessible. But for most people, following the manufacturer directions on how to remove the data, it is a very easy to do and very effective defense against getting their data being in the hands of somebody else.
That's where Privacy for Cars comes in. That's where your app comes in, is helping people get that right.
Yes, we have a free app that people can download and you can just search for Privacy for Cars, which is privacy number four cars on the App Store or Google Play, depending on what kind of phone you have, and download it for free.
The last time on the podcast we talked about this topic was a little over a year ago, October 2019. I'd gotten a notice from Hertz that they had changed their terms and conditions. I noticed that Hertz had specifically carved out liability from me leaving information from a Bluetooth pairing. And now on one hand, I mean, I could see that point. I mean, I've actively and voluntarily synced my phone to the car, and in doing so, cause my information to be downloaded. But at what point does that sort of digital maintenance, clearing personal identifiable information after every rental, really become part of the rental company's overall maintenance responsibility, kind of like checking the oil levels and the tire pressure?
I believe that the time has already passed and it's been in the past for at least a year, right? At least at the passage of California Consumer Privacy Act, and probably you can go further back in the past because of other types of regulations. And there are some regulators who have spoken about this. So in the United States, you have the FTC that has issued already, I think, four guidances on the need to delete personal information. In Europe, they went as far as to give a guideline that mandates the removal of the personal information. Beyond the rental, probably when they're traveling, sometimes they rent, sometimes they ride share. And very often it happens to me that I'm in a Uber or a Lyft, and you have a very nice driver that tells you, hey, do you need to fill up the tank on your battery? Here's a cable. And the first thing I do is glance, where does the cable end up? If it goes into the lighter, that's only power. So yes, I'll recharge my phone. But if it goes straight into the USB of the car, don't charge the phone unless you're really desperate. Because as soon as your phone will power back up, it will start downloading all your information into a stranger's car. So you definitely don't want to do that.
Andrew Amico, founder of privacyforcars.com. You can find his app on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. Andrew, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Mark. I really enjoyed talking to you.
The The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is 2021 travel planning pro tips. I've been talking about travel planning in this time of COVID across, I don't know, maybe 6 months of episodes, including some comments earlier on in this one. And since January is always a big travel month, especially this year with some vouchers from last spring's flight cancellations coming up on their 12-month expiration dates, combine that with 10 months of pent-up travel demand and, I don't know, maybe another 6, maybe 9 months to go, as we talked earlier, I thought I'd pull together all of my planning tips in one spot here in this section of the podcast. And I'll probably also have it on a blog post for the website when I get back from Tucson. So first tip, book now. As I said earlier, there's a steady stream of sales out there right now as airlines, hotels, and rental car companies are looking for cash to get through the start of this year. There are great domestic deals now, and if you can part with some cash now, good international deals for the second half of the year. And if you think about it, prices are only going to go up as vaccination rates improve and as that pent-up demand overwhelms any squeamishness about sitting next to a stranger. I'm eyeing that same American O'Hare to Barcelona 787 nonstop flight that I was not able to take at the end of last September. Now, the deals aren't as smoking as they were last March when the travel world was in a free fall. The airlines have gotten a little smarter over the past year, but with cancellation fees still waived, really there's not that much of a risk. Second tip, check your destination's health requirements. And then keep checking right up until the time you leave. Many of the airlines have built good web resources that do a great job, really, of summarizing all the restrictions by destination. Of the U.S. majors, I think United's webpage on this is the easiest to use, but I actually think that American's is the most complete. And American, they didn't do it themselves. They actually link out to a Canadian company called Sherpa that, when I was playing around with it, they took my Arizona itinerary and noted that while there's no quarantine restrictions in Arizona, there will be one when I return to Chicago. And Delta's got a pretty good one, too. I'll put links to all of them in the show notes, but you can't check once and be done. We talked at the top of the show about Canada putting in new testing requirements with 7 days' notice. And domestically, states are changing restrictions weekly. Now, you know, one trick I've talked about before is to start following your destination's local newspapers on Twitter to get any early warnings about any new restrictions or any changes. Third, read the cancellation rules for any component of your trip a lot more closely. Being nimble and able to react to changes at your destination, like what Irene and I did with our pivot from San Diego to Tucson, being able to do that depends on being thoughtful about the cancellation risks you take. Right now, flights have the lowest cancellation risk, Airbnb and vacation rentals the highest, hotels kind of in between. Our default strategy then is to book the flight as soon as we can, don't do prepaid hotel rooms or car rentals, and wait as long as we can before booking an Airbnb. Fourth, overload your itinerary with outdoor activities like hiking, biking, so last-minute closures or restrictions don't leave you sort of aimlessly flipping through the hotel TV channels. Outdoor recreation was the big trend last summer. Airlines dialed down flights between big city pairs like O'Hare and LaGuardia and pivoted toward beaches and mountains, and it continues now. All the imagery in the airline and hotel flash mail emails that I've gotten over the past couple of weeks is all about outdoors. But it does mean spending more time trolling the AccuWeather and Weather Channel websites because an outdoor-heavy itinerary is absolutely going to be more vulnerable to big storm fronts and temperature variations. And finally, just to wrap it all up, stay flexible, expect delays, and be patient. If there's anything we've learned in 2020, it's that something will screw up your plans. A positive COVID test will shut down the restaurant that you really wanted to eat at. Capacity restrictions will mean a line to get into something that was on the top of your list. Have backup plans and give everyone you meet the benefit of the doubt. Like you, they're just trying to get through all of this safe and sound. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Trevor Cummins podcast number 171. I hope you all enjoyed the show. Hope you decide to stay subscribed. Better yet, I hope you decide to tell a friend about it and get them to subscribe. In this episode's tech notes, and I've said this kind of as another running theme as I've been tweaking some things behind the scenes of the podcast, I've wanted to kind of summarize them for you guys. So now if you check out the show notes for this episode, you'll find now a full transcript of my interview with Andrea Amico, actually courtesy of my free tier of service with Amazon Web Services. And that free tier includes 60 minutes a month of their transcribe service. I learned about it actually when I was watching a session during their virtual reInvent conference. Now, back a year or so, actually a couple of years ago, back in episode 147, I talked about going to the reInvent conference in person in Las Vegas. Me and like 50,000 other attendees, mostly pudgy, pasty-faced guys, power walking up and down the Vegas Strip, backpacks strapped down tight, ignoring the showgirls on the corner so they wouldn't be late to, I don't know, the sold-out tutorial on best practices for ingesting streaming data from IoT devices. This year's virtual conference was, you know, less stressful, but less exercise and less entertaining. Anyhow, watching the session on transcribe got me thinking about how I could use it for the interviews that I've done over the past 12 months. So I've started on this most current episode, this one, and then I'm working my way back through the episode. So far, I've got this interview with Andrea, episode 167's interview with Matt Schulz about travel credit cards, and episode 166's interview with Emily Thomas about philosophers and the meaning of travel. I'll keep chipping away at the backlog as my 60 free minutes a month allows. And hey, as always, you can find the Travel Commons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Amazon Music, as well as asking Alexa, Siri, and Google to play Travel Commons on your smart speakers. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading subscribe. And then right below that in the social media section are links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you've already subscribed, how about leaving us a review on one of those sites? Helps people find the podcast and kind of join this happy band of travelers. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send it along, text or audio file to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com or mpeacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons page on Facebook, the Instagram site, post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. I really appreciate it. And until we talk again next month, take care, be safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.